You know, for the first time since I've known Chris, I think I know something he doesn't. We had a translator back there, Sam and I. I swear to God, this guy, we're back there cracking up. You're sitting next to a lot of disease right there. That's a very sick man. Well, you know, I still can't believe that I'm in Iceland, and I want to thank the committee from the bottom of my heart for the opportunity of a lifetime to come here and hang out with like-minded people. We get the opportunity to do this all over, and it's just not always the welcome mat. You know what I mean? The attendance today for the workshops was over the top. We expected it to diminish at some point, but you guys just kept hanging in there. We had to wake you up every now and then, beating on the podium. But we're glad you're here. My name's Larry Scott, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm free tonight. On December 31st, 1987, God intervened in my life. And there's something I want to say at this point, based on the nature of this conference, that I've never said at the podium before. I got a lot of heroes out there. I listened to a lot of speakers. I befriended a lot of those people. But until Chris Raymer's CD got into my hands some years ago, I walked around in an existence of secrecy, and I withheld what I thought and what I felt because it wasn't accepted in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said things and I behaved in a manner that was people-pleasing. And I heard this guy and I thought, wow, he's saying the stuff that I believe, the way I feel. I've since become somewhat unpopular, but it's okay. I'm not here to make people happy. I'm not here to piss people off. But now, when I hooked up with Chris and the guys that he is associated with all over the country, there's just a huge growing segment of our society that I'm so proud to be a part of. And this society is part of you. You're part of that. When I tell you that I'm free tonight, it means that I've recovered. I've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I no longer have to dance with the beast. When I say that, the heads are doing this because you get it. I don't have to do that anymore. I walk around the planet a free man. My home group is called We Are Not a Glum Lot. We're a book study, a Joe and Charlie style book study. We meet Thursday nights at 8 o'clock in Atlanta. If you're ever in our town, please come see us. We have a lot of fun in there. There's 150, 175 people that show up every Thursday night, and they're not there for the... It's not a social hour. We have a lot of fun, but we tell the truth there, and we tell the truth out of this book. I have no opinions about this. This book doesn't need my interpreting. It needs my doing. In the early days, like in the infancy, before there was an Alcoholics Anonymous, Ebby Thatcher hooked up with Bill Wilson after his experience and little piece of time with the Oxford groups. And they told Ebby, they said, you're going to need to carry this message out to somebody else if you want to sustain this newfound sobriety. Well, he knew about Bill. They drank together. They were madmen together. So he says, I got just the guy. I'm going to go over and see old Bill. He needs my help. And I'm not going to bore you with that story. It's in the book. But what he did is he showed up at Towns Hospital, and he carried Bill Wilson through the steps in days. And I tell you that because if I want what they've got, and I damn sure do, I want all the goodies in this book, I got to do what they did. I can't water it down and change it to where it's comfortable or it fits for me. I don't know anything about treatment centers. Never went to one. That was a luxury that was not on the docket. My story is an angel called Talmadge Scott, my brother, showed up in my life and he placed my hand in yours. And my story is real simple. If you want the short version, it's kind of like that cat that screwed the skunk. I didn't get all I wanted, but I got all I could stand. But I was dying out there. So, Dr. Silkworth shows up in Bill's room and he tells Bill, because Bill thinks he's just morally unfit, just no good, like most of us felt. And he told him, he says, "Bud," he says, "you got a disease." And he said, it's an obsession of the mind. And when you start thinking about drinking, you cannot with sufficient force stop that thought process and you drink. Bill said, "Yeah, that's me." He says, "And once you start drinking, you set into motion the second component of this thing. It's called the allergy of the body. You're allergic to alcohol. And when you start drinking, you cannot stop." Bill said, "Yep, that's me." And he tied it all together with that spiritual malady thing. Well, Bill thought, well, hell, with what he knows from Silky and this information about carrying the message, he grabbed a Bible because that's all they had. There was no book. There was no AA. And he started going up and down the Boweries and the alleyways, the bar rooms of New York City, snatching drunks off of the bar stools and beating them over the head with the Bible. Nobody's getting sober. So he goes back to Silky 5 or so months later, and he said, "Dr. Silkworth, I can't get anybody sober." Silkworth says, "Bud," he says, "you got to stop beating these drunks over the head with the Bible." He says, "They're not going to stand for it." He says, "Go out and tell these people what I told you. Tell them about the obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body, Bill. Tell them what I told you." Just so happens his next prospect was a guy by the name of Dr. Robert Holbrook Smith in Akron, Ohio. It's really a miracle how those two men met. But they met in the gatehouse of the Cyberling Mansion, an heir to the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company. Very small room. Bill showed up, and Dr. Smith had been on a run. He's snaking, and he's shaking, and he's sick. And he'd already extracted a promise from his wife to get him out of there in 15 minutes so he could go get the booze that he needed because he's sick. He's got to feed that demon. He walked in the room, and he ran his shaking hand across the table at Bill Wilson. He says, Mr. Wilson, I don't know what you think you can do for me." He says, "I've been prayed over and carved up more than a Christmas goose." Bill took his hat off and looked him dead in the eye. He says, "I'm not here for you, Dr. Smith. I'm here for me." Because Bill knew that the 5.5 months that he had under his belt, the only way he'd sustain that was to carry this message yet to another alcoholic. And look around. This is the result of that evening. This thing's all over the world. I heard the other day there's 150 meetings or 150,000 sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous in Iran. And they're meeting in the mosques over there. Get out. How does that happen? I love it. So early on, before we had this program, it sounds to me like Bill was doing some good fifth tradition work, huh? Good 12-step stuff. That was on the day before Mother's Day of 1935, May the 12th. And it wasn't long before they started carrying the message. And my friend Chris alluded to it today. It took them a long time to get just 10 guys. It was 18 months, right? And today, our numbers have exploded. My whole life, I've loved things that are real loud. Motorcycles, cars, fast cars, hot rods. Love beautiful women. Still do. Still got two big motorcycles. They make a lot of racket, burn high-test gas, and they will burn the highway up. I love that stuff. I love beautiful women. And my God, you guys have got an abundance of them. Please. We'd have to go to a meeting every day for a month to find this many women in AA. And most of you guys are overpaid. You're way out of your league with some of these gals. Just saying. We talked about the three types of drinkers today. There's four types, actually. Social drinker, hard drinker, problem drinker, and a real alcoholic. And that's me. I'm a real alcoholic. I've never had one of anything. And what I've learned over the years, if alcohol doesn't do something for you, it won't do anything to you. I'm a single guy, and I'm out on the dating scene, and I went out with a gal recently, and I said, server came by and says, "What could I get you to drink?" And she knew I was in AA, and she says, "Do you mind if I have some wine?" I said, "No, help yourself." I mean, there's a refrigerator full of booze back at the hotel, but it's not going, Larry, Larry. Doesn't do that. So she orders this glass of wine. It comes out, and it sits on the table, and I start looking at the glass of wine because I'm trying to figure out if she's going to be my future ex-wife, right? I got to monitor the drinking. So, you know, she takes a sip, and waiter comes over and says, would you like an appetizer? Yeah, the appetizer comes. She sips the wine. I'm watching the wine. The salad comes. She's sipping. Main course comes. She's sipping. And she says, could I get a glass of tea? I'm watching that wine. So the tea comes. The meal's finished. The waiter comes over and says, would you like an after-dinner cocktail or a cup of coffee? I said, I'll have a coffee. She says, I think I'll have a coffee too. There's a half a glass of wine left. Original glass. So we sip the coffee. We get a piece of pie and still a half a glass of wine. The check comes. We get settled up and I look at her and I'm really serious. I said, are you going to finish that? She says, oh no. Oh no. I'm beginning to feel it. The classic one is, oh no, I'm beginning to feel drowsy. Well, my response is always the same. Push through that. On the other side of that is like Disney World, man. Come on, let's go. You know, drink up. My first drink happened when I was about 6 years old. Moonshine liquor in the south part of Georgia. Here's what happened in that first sip. It burned like hell. Moonshine, probably 150 proof. And it smelled like the devil. I wanted to throw it back up. Nothing, it wasn't like, oh, I had my first drink and I was free. Not my story. I swore I'd never do that again. Most horrible tasting stuff. Why would anybody do that? Little did I know, I would chase that horrible experience for the rest of my days. The progression went from, I grew up in Jacksonville, Florida, which is the northern part of the state, butts right up to the south part of Georgia. And in the summertime, my parents would send me to Georgia to work in the tobacco fields for my uncles and that. Well, I was so small that I really couldn't do any of the physical labor, so they would put me on the tractors. Tractors are loud. They burn a lot of gas. I love things that do that. So at lunch, when the farmhands were in the house having lunch, my job was to take the tractors out to these big 1,000-gallon tanks and hand pump gas into them. Well, there's no automatic cutoff on them. So I'm laying up on the hood of this tractor and I'm pumping and I'm listening and I'm sniffing. Well, they'd walk out and find me passed out on the ground underneath this tractor. I discovered early on, I love gas. So at the end of the summer, I went back home to Jacksonville. I went right down the street to the gas station, got a job. Makes sense. I mean, if you like to drink, bartend, man. But I'm into the gas gig, you know, so I'm down here and there's no automatic cutoffs. I'm pretty old. So I pull down the thing and I'm listening for the gas to come in the fill neck of the gas tanks. And it'd find me passed out in the driveway of these gas stations with gas spewing everywhere. I love gas. Well, some years later, I discovered that you could put some model airplane glue in a bag and escape. I went to jail for sniffing glue. Me and 14 others before school one morning, huffing glue in the alley. They don't know why they locked us up. They couldn't figure out what was in the bag. They knew it had to be something illegal because we looked way too happy. But, you know, do you see where this is going? I have a buddy back in Jacksonville that has run with me. He's stuck everything in his arm and his face. He drank it. I mean, we did it all together. And he's not one of us. He can just say no. But back in the day, me and this guy, his name's Danny, we would scour the alleys in the metro area in downtown Jacksonville. And we're back behind the retail shops where the winos and the drunks would go back to drink their port and that. And they would discard their bottles. Well, Danny and I would walk up and down the alleys and we would find a large bottle. Spin the cap off, throw it away, and we would pick up whatever bottle was there. And whatever remnant was in that bottle, we'd pour it into one bottle. Port, bourbon, vodka, gin, Lovely combination. And then after we'd get about this much in a quart, we'd flip a coin. Here's the catch. Not to see who had to drink it, but who got to drink it. And then the next day, you know, the cycle would start again. So I've always chased that buzz. And I'm not real selective on how I get there. I just want to get there. Glue, gas, wino cocktail. My story is this. I've always been wide open. Never had one of anything. My brother, who 12-stepped me, our slogan was, oh dear, don't screw with it. If I didn't do enough to where I almost needed to go to the hospital, I didn't do enough. If I didn't get the crap scared out of me, I got to do a little more. I'm not a social drinker. I'm not a social user. And my favorite thing to do is more. I love more. I got married early. I was a child of the 60s, and a gal that I had gone to school with, she was my out. I was raised in a Baptist home, and I needed to get out of that house. There was no alcohol. You couldn't say damn in that house. They'd kick your ass for saying that. So I needed to get out of that house, and she was my ticket out of that Baptist home. So at 18, I got married. Sounded like a good idea at the time. We set up house, and it was a very violent five-year deal. A lot of everything. And is it okay to talk about drugs in here? Well, we did a lot of dope, and we drank a lot of booze, a lot of violence. And before I got divorced, I mean, when I married this woman, she was 5 feet tall and weighed about 96 pounds. At 5 years, she's still a little less than 5 feet tall and weighed 175. Do the math. I mean, when she hauled ass, it took two trips. But I'm in the hospital. I'm in the hospital with a kidney stone one day, and I meet this chick through a turn of events that I kind of interviewed her covertly, and I found out that she liked to drink and use the way I did. Not only that, she had a key to the candy store because she worked for a doctor. And I'm thinking, this is cool. So we set up house together. I get a divorce, and Debbie and I set up house together. And when the office would close at night, we'd go down there with the key. And they had these big jugs of Sakinol and Cinca Bravitol and gallons. Spin the cap off of it, just fill up baggies. I like Debbie. I really like Debbie a lot. Debbie and I, we had some friends over one night. We were living in a house that was built at the end of a dock out in the middle of the St. John's River, big river in Jacksonville. And our house sat way out in the middle of the river at about 100 yards out this dock. And we're out there smoking a big hookah pipe one day, and my buddy Joe was with me, and he goes, I mean, we're pretty ripped. He goes, dude, do you know anybody in a boat? And I go, well, dude, we're in a river. And I look, and this boat is booking, man. It's coming right for the dock. And about that time, helicopter starts hovering. I look at the other end of the dock up where the land is, and there's like 15 cars, unmarked narcotics guys. And you know where that story goes. We ended up in jail, made the front lines of the headlines of the paper and TV, and shameful, shameful. Didn't tap the brake, just kept running. We're in 1971, and I had the opportunity to go into the rock and roll radio business. And since this is Iceland, you may not know this, but in Jacksonville, Florida, at that particular era, starting around 1969 up through probably mid-'80s, early 80s, it was a mecca for southern rock and roll bands. The Allman Brothers Band, Lynyrd Skynyrd, 38 Special, Molly Hatchet, and the list just goes on. And while I'm at this radio station, these bands would come in to promote their new albums and to do interviews and that kind of stuff. Well, I hooked up with them. They like to drink and use like mad men. Well, so did I, so we hooked right up. And I ended up leaving the radio station after a period of time. Well, several radio stations. I drank my way through a bunch of them. But I ended up going to work with the management team for the Lynyrd Skynyrd Band. And this was 1974. And the part of this story that I'm going to share with you is not about glamour and glitz. Because if you put a dollar with it, you can get some coffee. Because I never hit the golden ring. For a long time, I thought my identity was wrapped around being in the rock and roll business with this famous band. And the point I want to make with you at this point is called God's grace. Sam hit on it this morning. Grace is undeserved favor, unmerited mercy, if you will. And there were so many times out there running like I was running that I should have died. I should have died at my own hand, either by an overdose or at the hand of some shady people I was dealing with. And it came close a lot of times. I've been held at gunpoint a number of times. But the point is, this has nothing to do with luck. It has nothing to do with coincidences. We were in a biker bar one night, me and the bass player from Skynyrd, and it's called Fling Nasty Saloon. Very upscale place. And this guy comes in, and we're all pretty loaded on whatever it was. And this guy is in the wintertime. And he goes, does anybody like to fly? And I said, I love to fly. He says, well, let's go for a ride. It's really cold. It's about 10 o'clock at night. So I never asked for his pilot's license. Hell, I just got in the car and we went. We went out to Hurlong Field, and he parks. He says, wait right here. I'll be back. It's a grass parking place for all these airplanes. And there's a little trailer over there. And then there was a small runway. And he gets out of the car, goes in this trailer, and he comes back out. And I see he's got keys. And he jumps in a plane, and he's in there for a few minutes. Nothing happened. He jumps out. He goes back, and he comes back with more keys. At this point, I realize we're stealing an airplane. So finally, luck of the draw, this guy gets his puppy fired up. He's in the plane, and you hear, wah, and you see the flaps. And he the door's open, and he goes, come on. And I'm thinking, you know, if I had good sense, I'd have said, no, it's okay. But I didn't. I'm an excitement junkie. Let's go. It's adrenaline. So I jump in the plane, and we take off. And it's not going well. Thank God I'm loaded. It's not going well. And he says, where do you want to go? I said, well, let's buzz Fling Nasties. And he did. He buzzed right over the top of the power poles and does this. And there's this bridge over the Temecula River, and it's got this archway like this, a little small archway. We flew under that, right over the top of the water. It's dope, man. That ain't nothing but dope. So God had a shot that night, passed. So I had a deal get sideways, and a guy owed me a bunch of money. And one Wednesday afternoon, beautiful sunshiny day, I show up at his house to collect this money. And he's in the sunroom of his house. He's got a needle in his arm. He's shooting cocaine. And I thought, well, that looks good. Did you have any more of that? And he said, yeah, back in the bedroom. And he told me where everything was. So I went back, and I had done that before, but not myself. Somebody else had administered it. I went back. Remember, I said, I'm a pig. I'm a pig from the ground up. I went back, and I took whatever I thought was right, and I dropped it in the spoon, pulled it up, holding myself off, and I went, bam. And all of a sudden, I go, I'm falling. Overshot the mark one more time. This guy comes running in. Now, this is a healthy, virile man. To my knowledge, there's no health issues at all. He comes and he grabs me by the armpits and he drags me to this other room, and he's got a scuba tank. And instead of having air, he had oxygen. Instead of having a mouthpiece, he had a mask. This guy was prepared. He knew some shit like that was going to go down. So he drags me out there. He drags me out there, and all of a sudden, I'm back. God had another shot. I'm not going to go into all the ODs. I mean, it's not worth it. You get it. If you're here, you know what I'm talking about. So I'm working with the Sur Productions out of New York, and we're Lynyrd Skynyrd is out doing their tour promoting their new album. They're debuting it all over. It's an international gig. Fateful day, October of 1977. I was at an autograph signing party with these guys. And an MCA record company executive came up, and I don't remember what it was, but we got into a pretty violent argument about the way this was going to go down. Well, this was the final flight of the old prop plane, the Freebird. And they were to land in Baton Rouge and pick up the new Learjet. God intervened. I did what I always did. Screw you. I'm not getting on the plane. Later that night, we got the call that the Freebird, along with all my buddies, had fallen into the swamps of Macomb, Mississippi, taking the life of a lot of really, really close friends. The point of that is I walked around, and I tell you, what a coincidence I didn't get on the plane. What a lucky break. Had nothing to do with it, because see, all my life I failed at everything I've attempted, whether it was relationships or jobs or whatever the case may be. God had a plan for me, and it's to be here with you. It's to take this message out and share it with those that are hungry for it. I didn't die that day. Skip forward. Life pretty much falls apart. Went through just an ass load of money of a buddy of mine's that had an ass load of money, and we went through it pretending to be in the music business. And drugs, sex, and rock and roll, it didn't take long. We went through about 1.5 million American. We had the big cars and fast women and all that stuff. But anyway, we both hit a bottom. At the end of about a 2.5 year run, we both became homeless. So this guy, once again, he was a very, very, very wealthy man. At the end of the run, I'm escaping Jacksonville. I moved to Atlanta to move in with my brother. Homeless. Didn't realize it, but I was. He ended up in Orlando, Florida, sleeping on the floor of our music attorney's home, homeless, burned it to the ground. This isn't his story, it's mine, but he is now a sober member of AA as well, over in Birmingham, Alabama. My friend Jan knows him. I'd been in a relationship off and on for about 10 years with a girl named Michelle. She had actually moved to Atlanta and gone to work for the same record company I did. And she liked to drink, she liked to use, but she's not one of us. She could stop. Doctor said she was a problem user, problem drinker. I don't understand that. No thanks, I got to go to bed. I have to work tomorrow. Well, it's 1980. I'm working for another record company in Atlanta. Short-lived, because at this point, 1980, I'm unemployable. And I'm not going to tell you my career history, but it's been beautiful. It's been varied, and it's been beautiful. I've had jobs that people would die for that like motorcycles and music. Been fired from every one of them because they said, you can't come around here smelling like that and acting like that. You got to leave, Larry. You just can't come back here like that. I found Freebase. I could stop right there and y'all could fill in the blanks, couldn't you? Freebase did the same thing for me that IV cocaine did for me, only I didn't have to stick a hole in myself. And I looked like death. I weighed about 90 pounds. And my eyes were sunk back in my head. I still carry my driver's license picture from that, from September of 1987, and it doesn't even resemble me. Well, Michelle came to me and she says, you're dying, and you can't do it here. You've got to go. I became homeless. I was sleeping around in abandoned cars, boxes, bridges, whatever. An occasional acquaintance would allow me a night on their couch or daybed, a night. I burned it down again. And I'm staying with this gal and her teenage kids in a suburb of Atlanta. Her name is Glenda, not one of us. Probably a banner poster child for Al-Anon, but she's allowing me to stay in this. It's not a relationship. She's being kind, and I'm staying there. And I'd gone to meetings because in October of 87, my brother, who's just older than me, he was my old running buddy. His name's Talmadge. He called, and he's, I don't know how he found me. He said, I understand you're in really bad shape. And if you don't get some help, you're going to die. Well, my response to him was, because I'm proud. It's okay, bub. I got this one. I'm good. He says, Larry, I know the truth. And if you don't get some help, we're going to bury you. And I said something like, well, what's your bright idea? And he gave me a hotline number, and I called it. Don't know who read, who led, don't know crap. But I showed up, picked up that white chip. And I'm thinking, I'm pretty proud of myself. And whoever gave me the ride, I said, could you pull in this liquor store? I need a couple of bottles of champagne to celebrate this. And they said, yeah. So I bought two bottles of champagne out of the gate. The white chip is still warm. But it made sense. So from early October until the end of December in 1987, I went to your meetings, just like Dr. Bob did. I would get drunk every night. And I would beg you to come home and let's discuss this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous because y'all were a little extreme on some of this stuff. And you looked at me like, keep coming back, dude. So I'm not using anything but alcohol at this point. And I found out through being with you, alcohol was my first drug. It was my last drug. And it was my drug of choice, if you want to call it that. It was always on the table, no matter what else was there. Alcohol was the baby, man. And all that other stuff that I poured in, this is my experience, was nothing but fortification. If I couldn't get there quick enough with the booze, I'd drop a couple of pills. Bam, take me the rest of the way. If I'm getting just a little too loopy, do a little blow, man. Bring you right back in the zone. You can drink some more. So December 31st, 1987, Glenda is in the kitchen. In our country, I know in the South, we cook a thing called collard greens and black-eyed peas for the New Year's Day lunch. It supposedly brings good luck. I've eaten enough greens to paper this place, and you know I'm still chasing the luck. But anyway, she's got this huge stock pot of collard greens on the stove, and it's rolling, boiling water. She's over at the sink. Now, this woman's about 6 feet tall, allowing me to stay in her house. She's cutting up these greens, and she's got the black-eyed peas on the stove. I've been drinking all day. From what I'm about, from here on, what I'm going to tell you is hearsay. I picked up the pot of boiling water and I poured it on her arms as she was in that sink. I proceeded to take off that Western belt that I had with the big Western belt buckle and I wrapped it around my hand. And I went through her house and I destroyed her house. Thanks so much for giving me shelter and food. Thank you for sharing your home. This is how I'm going to pay you back. I love football, college football. January 1st, 1988. I can't tell you who played. I can't tell you who won. I have no idea. I can tell you about the shame, the guilt, the horror, the remorse, because I could see the evidence of that last drink. And I had to go back to A&A. You picked me up and you took me because I had no transportation. I'm still homeless. For all intents and purposes, I'm still homeless. Took me back to that meeting. And what happened on December 31st, late in the night, God intervened. God intervened. He put my hand in yours once again, and this time I hung on. Because you see, when I got here this time, the book talks about the desperation of a drowning man. That's where I was. I couldn't live another day in that condition. When you go home tonight, fill up your kitchen sink with water. Take a good deep breath and stick your head in that sink. See how long your head will stay there. Natural reflexes will make you come out and gasp for air to save your life. That's where I was at. I needed you worse than Custer needed an airstrike. I needed Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a guy by the name of Don. He never took a seat. He always stood in the back of the room. How are we doing on time there, Werner? Good? Good. Good. We're good. So this guy, Don, he stood in the back of the room, and he never sat down. He'd spin that styrofoam cup and dig his fingernails into it. And every now and then, he'd open his mouth, and it was a pearl. Don was a stonemason, a real tough guy, and you told me I needed a sponsor. So I'd go, and when I got here, I'm the guy in the book. I didn't know the truth from the false. I was a madman. People wouldn't come up to me. They'd point me to the coffee, and you know, I asked about a half dozen guys to sponsor me, and they say, we'll get back with you. I'm a little crazy. Today, those are the ones I like. But these guys were like, whoa. So I went to Don, and I didn't want to ask Don because I knew that he was going to be the truth. And so we went to work. And we took the first three steps. And that's where that ride ended, and I'm not going to go into that because it has no redeeming qualities. But what Don did for me, he said, you got to become self-supporting through your own contributions. You got to get a job. And I said, I'll go back into radio or television. He says, oh, no hell you want. He says, that's way too high profile. You got to get a job where you're accountable. You're going to punch a time clock. You're going to go do landscaping or flip burgers, but you're not going back into that business. And I said, well, I'm living at my sister's house now with her and her husband. My brother-in-law runs an automobile store, a Ford store. And I grew up with him, and I said, but how about if I go to work for your company selling cars? He said, yeah, that'd be great. So I called Don, and I said, I got a job over at the Ford store selling cars. He says, that's not the way this goes. He says, you got to set up an interview. I'm going on the interview. I said, I know my brother-in-law. I grew up with him. I don't give a damn. Set up the interview. I'm going. I went back home, and I said, bud, I got to come in and interview. My brother-in-law, he doesn't get us at all. He goes, what the hell are you talking about? You're Larry. I'm Bud. You got a job. Come on. I said, you don't understand. I got this Nazi for a sponsor. So we show up at the interview thing, and Don's sitting there, and he's got these like 3x5 cards with all these questions and directions and demands that he's going to make of my brother-in-law. And, you know, a couple of them, he says he shows up on time or he's fired. If he doesn't agree to stay after, he's fired. He gets none of those house deals, those freebies. He works hard for everything he gets. And the only caveat is he has to have an hour a day to hook up with AA. Well, I said, fine, what else? My brother-in-law's looking at me like, who is this guy? You know? And I don't suggest selling cars in early recovery. I just don't, but that's me. I was heading home one night. And I shared this today in the workshop. I was heading home one night after a day at the car store, and I was loaned a car because it didn't come back that quick. And something happened that night on a highway running north out of Atlanta. It wasn't a burning bush. It wasn't a voice. It wasn't a flash of light. It was a knowledge. And that knowledge was that I never, ever, ever had to be alone again. Today I can be alone. At my home, can be alone riding that one of my bikes, but I'm never alone. I have this knowing that God has got me. There's a certain sector of our society that, and this is a warning to you guys that are new. They're called old timers, and they're mean. They prey on the young kids. They do despicable things. They say stuff that doesn't make any sense. You're convinced after a period that their senility is setting in. And I was going to this meeting where my brother was, the guy that 12-stepped me, and it was a group where average sobriety was about 40 years in there. And the old-timers were tough. I would go in, you know, I'd had my ass kicked at the car store, and I'd walk in there, and there's a guy named Bob Canatt, and Bob's setting up the chairs and putting out the literature, got the coffee going. Back then you could smoke, and the ashtrays were out. And he'd say, Larry, how you doing? I said, oh, Bob, it's been a rough day. I really don't like selling cars. Car salesmen are the scum of the earth, and a sales manager over there treats me like crap. He talks down to me. And Bob said, yeah, buddy. He says, you're right on schedule. You're exactly where you're supposed to be. And I'm going, this guy needs a hearing aid. We were sitting in a meeting one night, a discussion meeting. And they were going around the room and they were talking about whatever it was. And they came to me and they said, Larry, how are you doing today? I said, well, I'm great. My morning started off a little rocky, but I used that tool that you gave me, you know, turn it over. I can start my day over any time. Day started off really bad. I went in the customer lounge, pulled down some paper towel, got on my knees, grabbed the sink, and I turned it over. Started my day over. And now I'm good. Well, old Jack Blaylock sitting over here, old redneck from Alabama. And Jack would smoke those lucky strikes down to a roach. And Jack says, yeah, buddy. He says, Ed, turning it over, some good stuff. He says, back when I was in Alabama, I used to write them bad checks. He said, I turned them over to God. God turned them over to the sheriff, and he locked my ass up. I woke up one Saturday morning, early recovery, and I was doing everything you told me to do to the best of my ability. And one of the things was getting on my knees and saying please in the morning, saying that morning prayer. And when I got on my knees that morning, it was lip service. There was nothing coming from inside. I was growing a conscience. I didn't know it at the time. But my prayer was empty, and so I got on the phone and I called all these people. It was a Saturday morning. Nobody was home. Beautiful spring morning. And the person that finally answered the phone was a very tall woman, about 80 years old, named Jean Graves. Jean came from old Atlanta money, very southern, and everybody was darling. Jean always wore hair in a white bun. She always had that dangly jewelry, and when she came to a meeting, she looked like she was going to the ball. Flowing silks and satins. Sweet woman. She loved me so much, it was just pathetic. And she answers the phone. She says, hello. I said, Jean, it's Larry Scott. Hello, darling. I said, Jean, I got this problem. She says, tell me about it, baby. I said, well, Jean, I got up this morning and I hit my knees and I prayed. And all my prayers were coming from my lips and not from my heart. They felt empty. Long, pregnant pause. She goes, well, darling, pray about it. Old timers. I used to have this guy named Percy. He was an old black man, had a full beard, white hair. Percy had about 100 years, and Percy would come up to me on those Tuesday night meetings, and he'd have this book, and he'd say, Larry, you got a minute? I'm got 90 days, right? And he goes, Larry, I want to talk with you a minute. I said, okay, Percy, what you got? He says, man, tell me how this thing works. He handed me his book. I've heard how it works. So I sat down with him, and I'd open the book, and he's just over there grinning. And before I could get 10 words out of my mouth, he'd reach over and gently shut the book, and he'd say, Larry, it worked just fine. ...1992 rolls around. I've got the most horrible sponsor in the world. He's a fool. His name's Larry Scott. And me and this guy, man, we are doing everything wrong, and the world is caving in. So somewhere in that period of time, four things came to pass in my life. I'm not going to go into it. It has no place here. But they were things where I was under psychiatric care. I wanted to die, but didn't have the balls to do it. You ever been there? Wanted to die, but didn't have the balls to do it. And what happened is the fellowship, you rose up around me. You held me. You listened to me. You cried with me. You prayed with me. And you were vigilant in my life. I'm forever grateful for that. I had no program. My story's a lot like this guy's. I've floundered around here for 7 years. Actually, 5 years before someone came into my life and gave me some direction. I went to a meeting one night, and there was a guy sitting in there speaking, a real square-looking dude, wearing glasses, manicured hair, coat, tie, real square, and I'm thinking I want nothing to do with him. But as he started talking, he spoke to my heart because our paths had been identical. And he was the guy that you told me that I would find. And before he got home, I had him on the cell phone. I said, would you work with me? And he says, I will. He says, have you ever been to the Atlanta Men's Workshop, which is a 400 men out in the woods, three-day affair? And I knew about it. And I said, yeah, I've heard about it, but it's just not for me. He says, well, he says, either you'll go this next time or you'll find another sponsor. I said, when did you say that was again? So what this man did is he put the men in my life. I started out telling you I love the women. I still do. But today, not only do I love the women, I respect them. And we're going to talk about that in a second. He put the men in my life. And men taught me how to be friends with the women. I can do that today. Whew, what a gift. And I became an integral part of that workshop at a service level. And it taught me how to live and be free in a crazy world without drinking and using. That's what this man gave me. And we were together for 17 years. There's a pamphlet. I don't know if you guys have got pamphlets here. Do you have pamphlets in this country? There's a pamphlet called A Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what it is an overview of a guy's talk that he gave some years ago. And it's a great talk. It's powerful. And somewhere around page 10 or 11, depending on the printing of that pamphlet, it says, I am basically convinced that the, now he says, I'm personally convinced that the basic search of every human being from the cradle to the grave is to find at least one other human being before whom he can stand completely naked, stripped of all pretense or defense, and trust that other person not to hurt him. Because you see, that other person has stripped himself naked too. And then it comes with a promise. It says, this lifelong search can begin to end with your first AA encounter. This man became my guy. He knew it all, the good and the bad, and he never judged me. He never got angry with me. He never shamed me. He never did any of those things. He would match my inconsistencies with his own. And I felt in, finally, for the first time in my life, with another man. It's huge for me. I'm a woman guy. He put the binders on that. Well, a few years ago, I ran into a life situation that this man had no experience with, and it was life-altering. So there was a guy that I had known for 20-something years named Bob Crawford. And Bob, our whole relationship was founded in spiritual value and spiritual principle, and I asked him if he would work with me. It was a huge mistake because this guy, he's a Nazi's Nazi, but I love him. And we're on the same path. He's a thumper, and he sponsors a legion of men, retired attorney, but he's my guy. I'm thinking of the year. Seems like somewhere in the early 90s, I went to a meeting for social reasons. There was a group of people I hadn't seen since early recovery that were going to this meeting. And I went over just to say hi to them all. And all of a sudden, all they talked about was the book, the book, the book, the book, the book, the damn book. And I thought, Jesus Christ, what the hell is this? And one of the guys that was kind of like heading this thing up, named Dante, I went up to him. I said, you guys are a little over the top of this book, don't you think? And he says, has anybody ever taken you through the book, say, Joe and Charlie style? And I said, no. He said, why don't you come back over Wednesday night? I went over, and here's what happened. I walked in, and they opened the book to the chapter of wives. Didn't have one, didn't need one, didn't want one, did not pertain to me. I almost left. But I was being gracious. I sat there. And man, they brought that chapter. They gave it a whole new dimension. I went, wow. Dante says, what do you think? I said, man, yeah. He says, come over to Rob's tomorrow night. We're going to open the book to Bill's story. Now, I'm going to tell you my experience, and you might think I'm a little wacky after I tell you this, but this is what happened to me. We get to Rob's condo, and it's a long, narrow room. There's 16 men there. I'm sitting in the back. There's an empty chair right here, and there are two guys sitting at a table up in front of the room. And they opened the book to Bill's story, and here's what happened. They started telling us what Bill looked like. So I got a visual image. And they told us about how he was brought up, and they told us about the way he thought, the way he felt. And they talked about the drinking progression. And then they shared the consequences as a byproduct of that. And at some point during that meeting that night, I looked over and this empty chair had Bill Wilson sitting in it. He came to life for me. They gave him a pulse. And he was acknowledging the things they were saying. My experience blew me away. I walked out of there and I grabbed that old brick cell phone and I called a buddy of mine and I said, "Buddy, I've tapped into something we got to have." And these guys showed up at a treatment center that had volunteered a room for us, and me and my family and this guy's family, it was like 40 of us. We met every Tuesday night for an hour, 2 hours, whatever it was, and these men gave us 6 months of their life, and they brought this text to life. They opened a brand new dimension in my life. If you look in my book, it looks like Walt Disney puked in here. I'm not kidding. It's just highlighted and underlined. It's ridiculous. But at the end of that 6 months, I said, "Guys, I really appreciate this. This is great. Have a good day." And they said, "Oh, no, that's not the way this ends. You got to carry this yet to others." What a concept. Well, the treatment centers, it's been there about 40 years, and it's an inpatient for doctors and attorneys and pilots and all these white-collar people, and they invited us in to carry this message to the men patients. And we were there for 10 years. We were there for 10 years. And on a special night, we would all get on our knees one at a time and take that third-step prayer. And when that night came, the staff would show up to watch this happen. The staff was blown away. 10 years. And then all of a sudden, the spirit of rotation started chewing on me a little bit, and I thought it was time to pass that off to some of my guys and other men and let them experience this thing, this gift. And what I know today, when I talk about gift, I know that this book, the knowledge of this book and the information that I'm able to convey is a gift for me. It's God-given because I've never been a success at anything. So Christian and I, we've been doing this book study, and this gal named Karen Mack comes up to me at a Christmas party, and she said, "Listen, I've heard about what you guys are doing, and it's not fair." I said, "Why? What are you talking about?" She says, "The women don't have that opportunity. At this stage of the game, guys, I'm going to men's retreats. I'm going to men's meetings. I don't do co-ed. Because if I'm in a meeting up to this point and a woman walks in, I change. You're not going to hear the truth." You guys hook up with that? Just me. So I said to Karen, I said, "I'll get back to you on this women's thing." So I went to Christian and I said, "Brother, we've been invited to bring a book study to the women." And he said, "We need to pray about this." And we prayed about it for about a week. We really did. And the answer came that we needed to do this. And so the very first night, there were six women, and they're all hammers. They're all like tens, man. And they're sitting right here in the front row. And Christian and I are up at the table, and we're sorting through our materials. And I look up, and there they are. And I went, I put my hand on Christian's leg, and I said, "Buddy, we're in trouble." He looked up, and he says, "We got to pray." So we walked down the hall. We walked down the hall, and we prayed about it. And what's happened is God intervened into this womanizing guy and Christian. And all of a sudden, these women have become our sisters. This group, the We Are Not a Glum Lot group, Chris has been to our group. It's jammed with women, y'all. It's jammed with them, and they're hammers, man. And they come in there. If you get there, our meeting starts at 8. If you get there at 7:15, by God, you're going to the back because these girls are showing up and they're putting pocketbooks and big books and shawls. They're taking up the front rows. I asked Karen one night, I said, "What do you think about these treatment center guys hitting on you?" She said, "What guys?" See, they're blind to it. All they care about is this. They're there for one reason and one reason only, to sustain their life. The women. I extended an invitation to you. If you ever get to our country and you come to our group, God, you're going to love it. But there's kind of a caveat to that. Don't come in and hit on our new girls. Don't do it. We've had it happen, and we just asked the guy to leave. This is not a bar. These people are here to save their lives. leave our young people alone. They're coming in here because they're dying, and they don't need you distracting them. Something happened to me last year. We had a group of women, or men and women, from Al-Anon. They asked if they could come sit in on our book study, and we said, absolutely. And there was a pocket of them. They sat back in the back, and they were in the deal. And the matriarch of that family, her name was Barbara. She's the widow of my grand sponsor, Dennis, and she's got 30-some-odd years in Al-Anon, speaks all over the world. She says, would you bring this message to my family? It's called the WOW Group. We meet on Tuesday nights. It's not in the schedule. It's just me and my family. There's 50 women. I'm the only man that's ever been invited inside that room. Changed my life. Because you see, as we go through this, I didn't change anything. I'm reading the book. I'm reading the text. And the things that we laugh at, they're crying. The things we're crying at, they're laughing their ass off. People ask me, what meeting are you going to on Tuesday nights? I hear you're doing a book study. I said, yeah, it's called the Double Secret Handshake Meeting. Because, you know, it wasn't in the schedule. It's just his family. But it was an experience. And what I got to see as an alcoholic is I got to see what my disease has done to the other side. How it's harmed these people at a very close-up and intimate level. How many people in here can recall the very first time that you went to an AA meeting? Can I see your hands? The very first meeting you ever went to. I want to take you back to that night. You're sitting, you're either driving here or you finally end up in the parking lot in your own car or bus. Somebody brought you. You're court ordered, whatever the case may be. But once you get here, you're sitting in that car out in the parking lot. Go back to that moment just before you open the door and you're thinking of the contempt and you're thinking of the apprehension. What are these people going to look like? What are they going to say? How are they going to treat me? Is this really a cult? You're scared to death. And you didn't come here looking to get laid. You came here to save your life. It's the only reason people show up in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's usually the last stop. And we've hammered this weekend, but they walk in. The life of our future, the lifeblood of tomorrow, they walk in. And we talk about our problems. They walk out of here, we give them a cup of coffee, and we say stuff like, keep coming back. And you get that old geezer that says, just don't drink or use no matter what. What the hell does that mean? I'll tell you something, if I could just not drink or use no matter what, Iceland is a very glamorous place to be. I mean, really. But I got a full-blown life back in the States. I'd be home just not drinking or using no matter what. I can't do that. If you've got any degree of recovery, I don't care if it's 30 days, if it's 2 weeks, share your solution with this new person. That's what they came in here for. They can go back to the bar and hear about the problems and the divorces and the bad kids and all that crap at the bar. They don't need to come to AA for that. They came here so they never had to use or drink again. So I'll get off of that. I had the opportunity recently to speak over in a little town in South Carolina, and during the day before the meeting, I was with three separate people, and all three of them were talking about somebody in that fellowship. Did you hear about what's... Did you know? And when people start this gossip with me, here's where I go with it. Does it have anything to do with me? No. Can I do anything about it? No. Is any good going to come out of this conversation? No. I don't want to know it. Because you see on the first side of this triangle, that's unity. We did not come in here happy and well-adjusted. You hear what I'm saying? I mean, we're some pretty diseased people, but we're taking shots at each other because he said, she said. I need you, and you need me. We need each other, because I'm going to leave your country, and I'm going to stay plugged into you guys, because you got my email address here. You're going to be like a bad suit. I'll never get rid of you. But I like it. It's not who is an AA. It's what's here. Do y'all understand that? It's not who I am. It's what I am. I drink till I drop. Bill Wilson said some time ago, I think it was in, I don't know what publication it was, but he said that if AA ever folds, it'll be at the hand of the fellowship. This is perfect. This doesn't need anything, no adjustments, it's great. But if it ever folds on itself, it'll be at our hand. And that's why we're here, to hopefully transmit some truth about this message and keep it as pure as possible. And what my sponsor has taught me, if I just stick to the black part on these white pages, I can't go wrong. All the truth is right here. And, you know, there's pockets of enthusiasm, just like you're witnessing this weekend. They're all over the world. There's a primary purpose site, and Cliff Bishop sends out a directory, and it's amazing in this country and in the UK, all over the world. These pockets of enthusiasm, these little thumpers are getting together, and they're doing it, man. They're carrying this message, and they're doing it successfully. Some of them are having to fly undercover, but that's okay. They're still carrying it. Nobody's going to stop them. Joe McQueenie died about a year and a half ago. And when Joe was doing Charlie, and when he died, the phone started blowing up because the word got out that Christian and I were doing this 3-day book study workshop thing, and we get the opportunity and the real privilege of doing it all over the place. And from this vantage point, from the table where we sit, we get to see the lights come on. People are going, wow. Got an email back at the hotel this afternoon. A gal was in a book study we did last weekend, and she got it. She got it. And we get to see that. We get to see it on a regular basis. And that's the payment, man. That's the payback. That's the lottery right there. I don't know if a lot of you guys have been to our country. Next, in June, we'll celebrate 75 years of Alcoholics Anonymous. And last year, I had the incredible experience to get on my motorcycle with a group of guys and ride to Akron. Bill and Ebby and Dr. Bob, these guys are my Mick Jaggers, man. These are my rock stars. I just soak this stuff up about how this thing came down. So when we get to Akron, I befriended a guy named Mike Yule, and Mike is a trustee at Dr. Bob's house. And we got there early. We walked into Dr. Bob's house, and we got to sit around the table where he and Bob shared coffee. We're drinking this coffee, and Mike says, would you like to go up to Sue's room? This is Dr. Bob's daughter, where they did the surrender. And I said, absolutely. He took me and one of my sponsees up, and we knelt beside Sue's bed, and we did the first, second, and third step surrender. Whew. Wow. We went to the Mayflower Hotel. I saw the director where Bill chose the doctor to call for, or the reverend to call to get a hold of Bob. I went to the Cyberling Mansion. I stood there and I looked at this room. I got to walk in there where Bill and Bob met. We're going back in June. I think Sammy's going to go. We'll throw her on the back of my bike and we're going to Akron. I may kill her somewhere up around West Virginia, but we're going to leave Atlanta together. My point is, if you have the opportunity to go to Akron, do it. There's some magic in that town. There's some magic during that week. There's tens of thousands of us, and we're all there for one reason, to celebrate this new life that we've got. My brother Talmadge gave me this book, December 1987. A little tidbit about Talmadge. Talmadge was a very flamboyant gay man. He had a 37-year relationship with a guy that was successful and very happy. And all my life, I had a problem with his sexual preference. But once I did this work, my brother became my best friend. It didn't matter what he did. I didn't care. He gave me you. He gave me my life back. 2001, I got a call from his partner, and he says, "Your brother's had a stroke, and you need to come now." I had to drive about 75 miles. And when I got to Tanner Medical Center, my brother was laying there. We had tubes and needles and machines. And you showed up. You showed up. I was able to hold on to my brother as he passed to the other side, and you were there. You held me, you cried with me, and you prayed with me, and then a few days later, you were at the gravesite with me and my family. It's one of the hardest things I've ever done. Turn loose of the man that gave me you. The guy that saved my life. Once again, in February 14th, 2006, I'm laying in a hospital, and a guy's splitting my chest open, and he's got my heart in his hand, and you were there. Sam, you know what I'm talking about. You were there. You brought this program. You brought yourself. You brought the prayers, and you brought the laughter. You brought the unity to my room. Screw the gifts and the candy, man. You were there. You blew up my phone. You completely log-jammed my email. You were there. You've always been there. There's been a lot of twists and turns, and I could go on, but the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous has been with me through the divorce, bankruptcy, death. We've been there, and you've shown me that we can get through this because you would share your experience with me. I just did the same thing with my sponsor. He just had cancer surgery, and we're doing what we do, man. We're hanging around him and holding on to him. I'm going to wrap this thing up. The book says that we have to seek through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. I don't want to just establish a contact. I want to keep improving upon it. I'm spilling water everywhere. That camera was a good camera earlier. So what I have done is I've evolved over 22 years of prayer life because I seek through God. Seek through prayer to improve this contact. And we talked about it in the workshop today. My prayer partner is Christian, my book study partner. And I don't know who he's praying to, what he's praying to. Have no idea, don't care, none of my business. I've never asked him, and I never will. But I see the manifestation of a power greater than himself in his daily life. His life's exploding. Christian is also a dumpster diver, living a life beyond his wildest dreams. And when I'm seeking God through this prayer, I get four answers. The first answer is yes. Man, I love that one. The second one is no. I'm not real crazy about that one. And the third answer really doesn't set well with me. And that third answer is not right now. God, I hate waiting for something. The fourth answer is, I can't believe you prayed that shit. Alcoholics Anonymous has saved my life. It's given me just an incredible experience and existence. Every time I talk to my sponsor, Bob, he ends our conversation with this. Every time. He says, "I love you, Larry. Go with God. I'm really glad you're in my life." And that's what I say to you now. I love you guys. I really do. Go with God. I'm so glad you're in my life. Namaste. The God in me recognizes the God in you. Thank you.